talk about how to talk with practically anybody about practically anything. It is a book that I wrote. It's now in paperback. I would be delighted if you'd like to buy it, and then we could all talk to each other about practically anything. But I wanted to really speak about some other things tonight, which I think would be more relevant to you, I hope. It's very rare that I can go out and speak to groups like this, and for me it's an enormous pleasure. Sometimes doing a program, which we know goes to 6 to 10 million people, and yet never seeing them and never having any contact with, especially with the younger people, is very frustrating for us. And we have such crazy hours that it isn't too often that we can stay out after school hours. So I'm delighted to have the opportunity to see you, and I hope that when I'm finished, if you have questions, maybe we'll stop a little early and just talk with each other about anything you're curious about concerning television news, or some of the people I've interviewed, or some of the people in government or the arts or whatever that you're curious about. So I'll leave time for that, and we'll try to do that. In the times when I have traveled and talked to people, I've tried to think of what is the most interesting thing about me, or what would they most want to know about television, the program I've worked on. It always amazes me that the most fascinating thing about me is what time I get up in the morning. Especially with people who don't have to really get up as early. I know many of you do. People don't ask me what Henry Kissinger is really like, or what did I think of Jacqueline Kennedy or Onassis, but rather, how do you get up and how do you do the show that early? So just to get that out of the way, I arise every day at 4:30. It will include tomorrow as well. I get to the studio at about 5:30. I live quite nearby. I, for the benefit of the ladies, have my hair washed every 3 days and set every single day. This is the rain. And it's all done in those electric curlers, which have saved my life. Electric curlers and saran wrap, I think, are the two most important products in my life. And we go on live. It is a unique program. We are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. We are the oldest sustaining television program. I don't mean sustaining in terms of being without sponsors, but sustaining in terms of being on the air in an industry in which 1 year is considered somewhat of a milestone. We have a rather interesting story in Life magazine this week about those of us on the program and a little bit about the program. And it dismays me when I realize that most of you sitting here probably weren't born when the Today program began, and I remember it quite clearly. But as the Today program has changed, so has the society changed. I don't know which came first, whether we reflected or respond to it. But I want to talk a little bit about that as well, not because I'm out to plug the program or to talk about television news, but it is what I know best. With all modesty, it seems to me that I was invited here today for three reasons. First, because I'm a female who's been successful in a career in a time when the whole role of women is under minute investigation, and in a field in which there are still not that many women. And second, because I work in television in a time when television, and specifically television news, is more and more under examination, scrutiny, criticism. And third, because I do work on this program called Today, which has its own special meaning to all of us, as I hope to be able to point out. So I want to address myself to these three subjects and promise you, for your good behavior in listening, that you will have one fresh insight before this talk is over. First, a few words about the state of women in our country, as I see it, because we, I think perhaps more than any other program of the year, have done interview after interview and special program after special program on women's liberation and the women's movement at a time started about 5 years ago. I've now been on the program, appearing on it for 9 years, and began as a writer on it. rather beside the point in talking to you women and men. It seems to me that those considerations of women's liberation applied much more to my generation than to yours. We are the women in our 30s and 40s who are saying, is that all it is? Is this all I'm going to do with my life? You are not, you need not, and you probably will not ever have to ask that question. You can work or not work as you wish. You can marry or not. You can have children or not, without in any way being condemned by society. There are jobs open to you, and the closed doors of one-sex occupations are being opened, sometimes by inches, in the case of education, sometimes with government support, even intervention. More often, the doors are being opened by yards rather than inches. The point is that the choice is there for you, both personally and professionally. They were not for the women of my generation, but we didn't know it until very recently. You have the choices, and with them you have the responsibility of the total direction of your lives. That sometimes is a lot more difficult. Now, the main reason that I'm talking about women's liberation is that I have worked almost continuously since graduating from college. I'm also married, and I have a 3.5-year-old child. And this evening, in talking with you, I'm not concerned with those women who feel that the greatest fulfillment for women comes from working at a job of her choice. She has plenty of support, and she has mine as well. I wanted to direct my remarks to the well-educated woman who may find herself quite content after the birth of her children to stay at home, at least for the early years of the child's life. It used to be that a woman felt guilty if she had a child and worked, and now she feels guilty if she has a child and doesn't work. Not only guilty, but useless and bored. I think if I have one complaint against women's liberation, it's that it's given the woman who wants to stay at home a national inferiority complex. We began to receive a good deal of mail on the program now that we've done so many features on it. By the way, Gloria Steinem is going to be one of our guests next week because she has a new magazine called Ms. coming out. But we began to get a rather odd backlash from very well-educated women who are married, who want to stay home, especially when the kids are young, and who say, you know, we're up to here with hearing people say how empty and boring a life is if you don't work. There are so many things that we do that we are involved in, and why don't you say the other side? And I asked Gloria about this. I spoke to her last night, and I said, do you get letters like this? We're getting a lot of it. She said, no, I only hear from the men. Well, we hear from the women too. So I think what I'm trying to say is if your involvement and satisfaction comes from being with your child, comes from being at home, comes from pursuing whatever interests you have at that time, remember that here too, the choice is yours. Don't be intimidated. I know of a lot of very dull, unrewarding jobs, and I know of a lot of dull, unrewarded women who work. I rather hesitate to talk about the second reason. It seems to me that I might be of interest to you, and that is because I'm in television. And I wouldn't have had this hesitation if I were here a year ago. But I have heard that television today, and that's why I was joking when I walked in and found you watching it. The television today, especially television news, is becoming anathema to many sections of the campus. Just as for the past couple of years, it's been the target for so much of the not-so-silent majority of middle America. And so I feel, as I stand here, a little self-consciously like the enemy. I think I was much more comfortable talking about women's liberation. But it's important for us to all know something of how this disaffection occurred and what it means not only to the members of both ends of the spectrum, but also to the rest of us in between, which is, I think, where most of us are. These difficulties arose really before the famous Spiro Agnew speech of November 1969. It all began in August of 1968 on the streets of Chicago, when our camera showed America something it suddenly realized it didn't want to see at all. We thought we were really merely reporting the news as it happened. Thousands of Americans thought differently. They said that we distorted the facts, that we sided with the young, and that we helped to provoke the riots. Television somehow became the event itself, even the cause, and the old it seemed to me that every time Mr. Agnew made any kind of a speech, indeed if he just coughed at a public gathering, the television cameras were there, we recorded it and aired it. We were not about to be accused of deliberately ignoring anything the vice president said. As a result, we may have made him more important, or to put it in the vice president's now famous literature style, we may have made him more prestigious, presumptuous, and pompously provocative than he ever dreamed possible. Then, too, television had to be aware of the large number of letters sent in by followers of Mr. Agnew's point of view. For the first time, he told people of the power they had, which was important for them to know, whom they should direct their letters, how they should make their voice heard. It was not a silent majority by any means. And it took seriously the accusation that it was representing only a small, liberal, Eastern point of view. Television news did that work, although it felt that this was not so, tried even more earnestly to find new ways to allow the rest of America a voice. Our own program, for example, we now have a segment originating in Chicago called The View from the Midwest, and it's precisely that. In thinking back to the climate of that time, and it really wasn't that long ago, I remember that some weeks after the Agnew speech, Walter Cronkite visited his hometown of St. Joseph, Missouri, and he did a broadcast from a town hall filled with local citizens. And one young woman raised her hand and articulated the question which was being asked more and more by a public fast becoming irritated and angry at seeing campus eruptions reported night after night on television screens. Why, she asked, didn't television show all the hard-working students who were happy to be going to college and didn't want violent change? And because, replied Cronkite, you don't talk about all the cats who aren't lost and who didn't get caught up the tree. Television news has to respond to the source of the news, no matter when or where it is the most important. But about this time, it made an even greater effort not to lose sight of all the cats who weren't lost, and not to report on every single cat who clawed his way up that tree. And later, as a result of a variety of factors, which we're familiar with, the mood of this country changed, cooled down, became more thoughtful, and some say it's become apathetic. Well, whatever, television has recorded that as well. But in reflecting the country's new tone, and in trying more than ever to be fair, it seemed to further alienate the extremists, who felt that their point of view is being deliberately ignored by a pig-headed industry catering to every cause but theirs. We are radical liberals to the far-right conservatives, and we are establishment boobs to the young activists. Can't imagine what we're going to be called this summer when we start to report in the conventions again. We'll learn a lot of new words. Just recently, TV Guide magazine ran a five-part series on the rejection of television by the campus. It was a very informative article, and I'd like to quote from it, because it was the first time that the alienation of campus and television had been talked about in the so-called popular magazine. It said, for many of this country's 7 million students, television is alien terrain. A score of years of trying to sell to young people toys and breakfast cereals, as well as TV's own brand of reality in both news and entertainment programs, has produced in them only pervasive hostility. And Middle America when speaking of most of America. And what are they watching at 7 to 9 in the morning? What are these people so interested in seeing during the most hectic time of their day, a time when they could easily flip off the dial and concentrate on the whole business of getting up and getting to classes and going to do your housework, going to school? What I decided to do was to just take a random week, and because I didn't want to go through 52 weeks, I thought, all right, I'll start with the first week in January of 1971, and then that was kind of a special week because it came right after the New Year. So I took the second week, which was the week of January 11th to 15th, and this is what was on that week. Norman Mailer discussing the psychological makeup of the first moon landing astronauts. 1970 Nobel Peace winner Dr. Norman E. Borlaug telling of the special sheaf of wheat that may be the genesis of the Green Revolution. Dave Megacy, one-time linebacker who has turned against football and says it represents the worst in American life. Carl Hess, former speechwriter for Barry Goldwater, now a libertarian and an anarchist. A panel of homosexuals discussing their need for equal rights. Ivan Illich, Catholic priest and philosopher, discussing the nation's social problems. Chairman of the board of the Lear Motor Company demonstrating a new non-polluting auto engine. A Purple Heart Vietnam veteran discussing his new book, A Critical Look at the Military. Joseph Raw, founder of the Americans for Democratic Action, debating the value of American liberalism. And finally, the winners of the Junior Chamber of Commerce, 10 Outstanding Men of 1970, which included Ron Ziegler, press secretary to President Richard Nixon. Now that's hardly fun fare in the morning. It's hardly sugar-coated news or artificial confrontations designed to win an audience. And yet the rating of the Today program is at an all-time high. Well, goody-goody for you, you might be saying. But no, what I'm saying is goody-goody for all of us. For the great American public, that slumbering, silent majority, is at best trying to understand the profound problems which confront us, and at least it's willing to listen. All sides, all points of view, even if it hurts. I'm not sure it would have done this in 1968. I think it knows that it must in 1971. It's true that what draws most of the mail in our program, and in programs like this, is the occasional recipe discussed by a cooking expert. But even this is significant because it means that the same housewife who wants the ingredients for turkey stuffing often is listening to the kind of subject matter I've discussed and comes back even when we're not discussing turkey stuffing. It's also true that when we present a panel on homosexuality, the majority of our male criticizes us for airing such a discussion at all. But these same people continue to listen, and they must learn something as we report on abortion reform and race relations, changes in the church, politics, environment, education, medical care, and yes, even war. I'm not saying that it's an enlightened America we have now, or that you'll be going out to. And I'm certainly not saying that we have enlightened television all day long. I'm much too aware that following the Today program, the American public seems to thrive on a diet of quiz shows and soap operas. Maybe we'll find out one day that this diet is really giving everyone, including network officials, a bad case of scurvy. That would be very nice, but it hasn't happened yet. I can only point to the fact that millions of people do start out their day not only with an empty stomach, but also with a mind open to thought. It makes me feel as if there's never been a time when more people are trying more desperately to understand, for heaven's sake, what is happening to us. And I think of that these last few days when we've sat glued to our sets watching what seems to be an interminable farce as we see the UN going through the technicalities and airing their own private interests while two nations clash and try to wipe each other off the earth. But people want to know what's happening. People do care. People are trying to do something about it. And so, although I'm not optimistic by nature, I say that it isn't quite time yet to say stalemate. Nobody's listening. Drop out. Drop dead. But there is the danger in college talks like this of appearing too cheerful and becoming rather pompous and therefore not seeming thoughtful enough. So before you think that I'm giving us all too much credit and television too much praise, I would now like to read to you an actual letter received by NBC News just following the last moon flight. I read this letter whenever I'm in danger of having too much faith in my fellow men. I filed it under the happens, I shall notify the FCC. I can no longer think up answers to my children's questions about docking. And it's signed by a lady from Porchester, New York. Is that near here? If you want a pen pal, I will give you this lady's name. But from now on, I'll be willing to bet that whenever you see a space docking, you will look at it with new eyes. And if I promised you a fresh insight, and I hope that you've never quite thought of it this way before. I've talked a great deal about television news because it does affect so much of our lives. We are so intimate. But really, when I came here, this is the first time that I have been back to a campus in a very long time. And the college that I went to, although it's quite a different school, I'm always embarrassed when I say I went to Sarah Lawrence because somebody usually says it's figures. And I can't decide whether it's an insult or a compliment. Recently, the Queen of Sikkim, Hope Nimabuk, I can never pronounce it, Hope Cook, her name was, who I don't know if any of you saw her, but she went to Sarah Lawrence. It's so whispery, and so lovely, and so angelic. And when she was introduced, I heard the whole, and I said, and Miss, the Queen of Sikkim, the former Hope Cook, went to Sarah Lawrence. And from the control room, I could hear the director and the people saying, figures. But being here tonight, I find very nostalgic. And I find myself envying you because I think that this is the freest period of your life, although you probably don't think so with classes and so on. But it's a time in which you are so much more aware than you may be later, and so much more open to new ideas, to new thoughts, and to a lack of prejudice in all areas. But I thought it was important tonight, even though I think my book is very important, and I think it's terribly important to be able to talk to people and to feel comfortable and to feel at ease. Somehow this seemed to me a matter of more pressing need. So what I would like to do now is to stop the formal part. And let's just chat and see if you have any questions that I can answer for you. All right? Well, let's start with the gentleman right in front. Excuse me, I have some glasses way back there. Part of my problem is that I can see I have lots of problems, but one is that I can see close, but I can't see the rest of it. So if you could just bring my glasses down, I could see who I was listening. You I can see, you're close enough. Why don't you stand up and then the other people can hear you better, I think. Most of them have had to learn how to face cameras and been uncomfortable. comfortable, so they don't start out as artists or actors who may have a liberal point of view. If they are liberal, and you will find quite a few of them who are not, if they are liberal, it is because their experience has perhaps made them feel this way. Also, most of them, this Eastern establishment, I can't offhand think of one who's from the East. I mean, Chet Huntley went back to Montana. Frank McGee is from South Carolina. Walter Cronkite's from Missouri, and on down the line. So I think that presupposition is a fallacious one. In terms of why does television have the right to criticize, the president, the vice president, everyone else speaking for the industry, for the administration, presents their side. There were times, and there have been times since, when their speeches have been analyzed, especially in the last year or so, and the news media has seemed to be very much in favor of it. At that time, we're never criticized. It's only when there have been times when someone says, yes, but what about this? Yes, what about that? I don't think that we influence you all that much. I think that you have your own opinions. I don't think you're a nation of sheep who take everything that the television people say. I do think we are fortunate that we are able to criticize. What the vice president did was to make the industry take a look at itself and say, are we being prejudiced? Are we only presenting one side? But what I think is that it was not just that speech. It was a result of a great many other things of a climate of the time. And that's why I tried to go back to the period in Chicago. But newsmen are not born liberals, and they don't become liberals because they are artistic by nature. They're fairly tough, and they're primarily newsmen. Most programs. You may not hear this every night on your news shows where they have a much shorter time. But I think there is an enormous effort made, not only by us, but by CBS and ABC, to try, if not in one program a day later, a week later, whatever, to give the other side. There was one other problem, especially during all the Vietnam discussions, and that is that it was very hard to find our picture with conservatives. Nobody seems to have written a book about Vietnam who was a conservative or a hawk. It was very difficult to get administration spokesmen. And there was, I think, a tendency again and again to present one side, which seemed to be the prevailing thought. Certainly, almost always, whenever we had younger people on, that was the thought expressed. And we tried very hard to find the other point of view. Maybe we should try harder, but I think the networks are today trying harder. They're very conscious of what it is they're talking about. I even received a call last week from Martha Mitchell, who, by the way, called Collect. And she was complaining about a syndicated program on called The Phil Donahue Show. We're having a couple of fellows on named Evans and Novak, who's written a book about Washington, and were particularly criticizing H.R. Haldeman. And she said, you know, why don't you have somebody on opposite them? So the program has now been trying to get Haldeman on and Mrs. Mitchell on, or somebody who will, you know, who will present the other. You got to take the whole package. You can't just choose part of it. Can we have yes, the lady in? I can only think of one who did. You know, to the point where I became visibly upset with him on the air, and in the book that he's on your side, I can tell you got him saying. Yeah, in the book that I wrote, I don't like conversational games, because I think that there's a kind of a philosophy and a way of talking to people and of making them feel comfortable and reaching them if you don't share the same experiences. But I had 20 foolproof ways to purifier conversational starters. And then at the end of it, I thought, I really am making myself sound as if everything works, so I will tell my one example. Warren Beatty was on our show a few years ago, before he did Bonnie and Clyde, before he became, as I now hear, he is somewhat more mellow. But at that time, he was being very bored with it all. And he was promoting, plugging a particular movie. And no matter what I asked, first of all, he never looked at me. He sort of talked just over my shoulder. And he was looking around the room, and it was all just yawning. It was too dull for words for him. And finally, and just sort of anger and desperation, I said, look, Mr. Beatty, why don't you tell us about your latest movie? Which is, you know, the cliche question. And he scratched a lot and kind of itched his way through, and then he said, that's a very difficult question. And I said, Mr. Beatty, you are the most impossible guest we've ever had. We'll go to a commercial. That's the only time I've ever done it. I received cheers, you know. I'm immortalized in Rex Reed's book because he had the same problem with Mr. Beatty. I hear that he has changed, and I'm a lot more mellow. But no, ordinarily, most people who are on are people who want to be on. I don't always agree with them from my point of view. I don't think most people watching the show will know what my political point of view is. I've done a two-hour interview with President Nixon, and interviews with Henry Kissinger, with Dean Rusk, with Ted Kennedy. And each I felt that I was being fair, and certainly they did. I feel that I have a rather close relationship with each. It's not important for people to know how I feel. What's important for me is to draw the person out so that the audience knows him